Hello and welcome to Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney. Coming up in today's programme.
A work of art should always be inviting you to see something new. So even though you might think, well, I really love 19th century painting or whatever, you will find that as you move around the gallery, your eyes are constantly interacting with the work and you're always spotting something new about it.
I'll be bringing you the second part of my interview with Dr. Mary Burke, who is a keeper and the head of education at the National Gallery of Ireland, about the educational activities of the gallery. But first, we go to Barry Hennessy's second interview in his summer series entitled The View From Here. Today, Barry's guest is Pat King, the incoming General Secretary of the Association of Secondary Teachers of Ireland.
Pat King, General Secretary of the ASTI. Pat, you succeed John White, a man who arguably managed to unite the ASTI after the well-documented disagreements that marked the end of Charlie Lennon's tenure in charge of the union. Now, most of your own experience is in the industrial relations side of the union's work. Does that make you a conciliator or a heavy hitter?
I think I'm a conciliator. That's been the philosophy of my life, in fact, and problem solving is what I've been doing for the past 20 years as an official of the ASTI. I think modern trade unions operate on the basis of respect for those that we're communicating with and respect for those that we're serving.
Now, one of the first tasks facing you is the Croke Park Agreement, which has been accepted now by the trade union movement overall in the public sector, but obviously rejected by the ASTI, also by the TUI as well. So, where exactly does the ASTI stand now as we face into the new school year?
Well, as you say, the ASTI members in a ballot by a large majority rejected the Croke Park Agreement, and so also did our colleagues in the TUI. And after the public service unions made their own decisions, we looked at the position we were in, and by we I mean the executive of the ASTI, and we decided, number one, we reiterated our rejection of the Croke Park deal, and number two, we decided we would go and discuss the deal with our department opposite numbers and see whether through discussion and clarification we might be able to go back to our members and say, look, this is what the Croke Park deal is about. Because the problem with the Croke Park deal is that it left a lot of uncertainties. So we're looking now for clarification.
So is there in fact a realistic possibility that there could be a re-balloting of the ASTI members then?
Whatever comes out of our discussions, hopefully it'll be productive. Hopefully we'll get clarifications that we can go back to our members with and say to them, look, this is the position, this is exactly what's on offer, and we certainly will offer them a second ballot, provided there's something reasonable to offer them in a second ballot.
We'll turn to, I think, a couple more of issues now which might be regarded as broadly linked to the education area. And recently, Minister Coughlin has heralded a more structured approach to the issue of patronage in the post-primary sector. We tend to hear little or nothing from the ASTI on the issue of who should be managing our post-primary schools. Does the ASTI take a view on this?
I would point out that there has been in place over many years what was called a Commission on School Accommodation. COSAD was the commission. I actually was a member of COSAN, along with department officials, management bodies, other unions. So it's not an entirely new concept that you bring together all the partners, the parents, the managers and the unions and the department.
But, I mean, for example, one of the issues that arguably the whole patronage issue could be perceived as carrying over into is the issue of enrolment policies in schools. Is the ASTI going to take a stance towards ensuring that the enrolment policies of schools reflect the need to educate children in an inclusive and in a pluralist manner?
That would certainly be our view. We've always held this view. For example, way back we took a view in favour of co-education. But I would point out that this is mainly an issue at primary level, primary school level.
But it will come, won't it?
It will come, but there are 4,000 primary schools. There are about 600 second-level schools. Second-level schools are much bigger. There tends to be one secondary school in a community, whereas there may be several different primary schools. So the issue of, by definition, therefore, second-level schools have to be inclusive, have to be open to all the children of the community. I think some of the concerns that are out there about concerns that a denomination may try to dominate, I think they're not well founded.
Except, for example, if you take towns, and there are a number of towns relatively close to Dublin that would have very, very high numbers of newcomer families compared to the national average. I mean, is it tenable that a school in that area would have an enrolment policy going forward which would favour siblings of existing pupils or even children of staff members? I mean, that's hardly sending out a message of inclusivity towards the real needs of the community.
Siblings, I would go along with, because I think it's a reasonable policy to have that brothers and sisters would attend the same school. I think that makes sense. Children of teachers, I'm uncomfortable with. I don't think there should be any priority for children of teachers going to a particular school. In fact, I would discourage the concept of children going to their parents' school anyway. Mm-hmm. We have no difficulty with variety in the patronage. In fact, we'd encourage it. And patronage should reflect the community, whatever that community is.
Pat King, we do appreciate you coming in very much, and all the best to you in your new role.
It's my pleasure, Barry. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Barry will have another interview in the View From Here series on next week's programme. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, which is www.insideed.com. You can contact the programme with your comments or suggestions to 086 8962 665. That text number again is 086 8962 665. Last week on the programme, I brought you the first part of an interview that I conducted recently with Dr. Mary Burke, who is a keeper and the head of education at the National Gallery of Ireland. In the first part of the interview, which was conducted in the gallery, Mary Burke described the work done by her and her colleagues through their programmes for diverse groups ranging from adult lifelong learners to children and families, and from youth and children to community outreach programmes. She explained how the educational mission of museums has evolved since the 19th century and the impact of educational theories on what galleries do. Above all, she described the resources provided by the museum to help visitors get more out of their visits to the National Gallery. Much of what Mary described last week related to looking and responding to art. We begin this week's interview with my asking Mary if the gallery organised any opportunities for visitors to produce art.
Oh, indeed we do. The drawing studies course for adults as part of our lifelong learning programme has been in place now since about 1992. And the interesting thing about that course is that we find quite a lot of students studying for the junior cert, transition year students, and students doing the leaving cert. You find them coming in and interacting really, really well with the older people who are doing their courses. Within our school's programme, we provide portfolio and drawing classes. We've been doing those for years and years and years. We do a number of different kinds of courses to interest teenagers in the collection. And all of our summer programmes and our summer, we publish brochures for all of the different age groups. So in the children and family activities, for example, you'll find a family programme every Saturday afternoon. You have the Discovery Club for Tiny Tots and Children, which is taking place in July. When that ends, we have the Picture This. It's a Sunday morning activity for children where they find out about a picture and do some drawing. We have midterm breaks where they come in. So the practical, not paint, but practical drawing in the gallery happens year-round for all ages.
And you mentioned some of the different groups that you cater for there. One was community outreach. Could you say a little bit about the community outreach programmes that you have, Mary?
Indeed, and I'm very glad you asked about them, because they're going to become more important in the next couple of years, because the gallery is going to be repairing its roofs and there'll be quite a lot of the rooms not available. So we're going to be doing more and more work out and around the country in that context, our education officer and our outreach officer, they do a lot of linking in with the education centre. So, for example, for the last 5 or 10 years, we've been doing study revision days all around the country in education centres in Galway and Cork and Athlone, whereby our team go down and do a very brief run through in different aspects of the Leaving Certificate. But we're going to be doing more of that now over the next couple of years, and our outreach officer, that's who the person, if somebody wants a tutor to come to the school, that's normally who they go to. Not to forget, by the way, the whole interactive area of the website. We are going to be launching our website in the next few months, and there's a huge section of that website devoted to learning.
This is relaunching the website, I presume.
And we have in the past put up, for example, when we have exhibitions such as the Meitsu exhibition that's coming up this autumn. The Meitsu is a very, very major exhibition. Meitsu was a contemporary of Vermeer. And that exhibition will be open in the gallery from the 4th of September until the 5th of December. So we have a very extensive public programme on Sundays and Tuesdays for people. Anybody can go to those. Mid-September, we will have a teacher's tour of the exhibition, which is our way of introducing teachers and letting them become familiar with it.
That's actually one of the things I wanted to ask you. Do you have any other specific programmes for teachers? Mm-hmm.
The Schools and Tours Officer, Helen Monaghan, is very close contact with teachers and a lot of the art teachers and other teaching organisations. And periodically throughout the year, we would do special tours for teachers, either just on the collection generally or specifically linking into an exhibition, which is something they're very interested in. So we would have that tour in September where we will bring teachers in. They'll have a relaxed visit of the exhibition. They'll ask questions. We will then put teachers' notes on the website and an activity sheet so that any teacher coming to the Meitsu exhibition can download those teachers' notes or activity sheets. They then can book a tour through the education department, and children are free on a guided tour of the exhibition if they book 2 or 3 weeks in advance through our education department. Then we have a guide who can bring the group through the exhibition, and then when the teacher brings them back to the school, she can have the activity sheets there to work with the group. So we tend to try and look at it as a multi-networked facility, so that there are things we can do in the gallery, there are things that we can do on the website, there are tools that we can give the teacher that we can post out to them, more and more of which are going on the website. And then as a further extension of that, there are situations where we can actually have members of the staff who are going out and meeting the teachers and the children in the school. And even on that area, we do have exhibitions that travel around the country. So, for example, a couple of years ago, we did a project called Learning from Art, in which we involved every county in Ireland, all 32 counties, primary school children, secondary school children and special schools. So we have this Learning from Art exhibition, which is touring the country, and children can interact with that, and there's an activity sheet to go with that. And we did the same thing with an adult one called Drawing Studies. And even with the Drawing Studies exhibition, which is all about the work of adults and how they have worked from the collection, there is also a little worksheet to go with that, so anybody can pick it up, and there are lots of hints on it on how to get started, how to draw portraits, how to draw landscape, how to draw sculpture. And that, in some ways, is a very good indication of the way the National Gallery works. We publish a little newsletter called The Gallery News 4 times a year. It's free. You can get it on our mailing list, or you can get it dropping in, and in that we advertise all of the things that we're doing, any new works to the collection, any concerts, anything like that. Education has its own page, and then we have 4 pages listing what's on. And so that pretty much every day this week, either on a guided tour or on the lunchtime talks or by using the audio guides or by picking up a family pack or by picking up an adult drawing kit or by using any of the children's programmes that we had. There's pretty much something happening every day in the week. Anybody who finds a painting that they like, we're often asked about it. Oh, I really like your Vermeer. I really like your Meeting on the Turret Stairs. I'd love to have a copy. The shop has copies of most of the works, and it's interesting, nearly everybody finishes a visit to the gallery by dropping into the shop and picking up a postcard. Children particularly, you're always hearing them say, oh, I want my own one, you know. So you can see them going into the shop and they say, well, I've only got this much, and going up to the staff, and the staff will say, well, actually, you can get 3 postcards for that. And they bring them home and they show them to their parents. And sometimes, curiously enough, it's the children who bring the parents in. They've been in on a school trip and they found a painting such as Stella with her flowered hat, and they're enthusing about it. And often you will hear a parent say, well, I've never seen that before. The attendants tell me that when they're in the room and a child says, Mummy, Mummy, come over and look at this picture we saw on our tour. And sometimes the parents will admit to the attendants, you know, I've never been in here before. My child has brought me in. And it doesn't matter to us, really. This is a public institution. It's funded by the taxpayer. It's open 7 days a week. And as far as we, the staff, are concerned, we really love to have people in here interacting with the collections of all ages. All ages are welcome.
And Mary, you've emphasised the fact that what happens here in terms of your work is informal education. But obviously a lot of arts education and visual arts education happens in formal settings in schools, whether it's primary or second level or third level. What do you think are the things that people in formal settings can learn from the work that happens here in the gallery, or vice versa? What can formal education learn from informal education, and what can informal learn from formal?
Well, I think it depends on the subject that you're teaching.
In visual arts in particular, actually. Yeah.
Well, I was going to bring it on to something like literature, English, or even history. We get a lot of the different teaching associations linking in with us here in the gallery and saying they're teaching history, and how helpful it would be if they could draw on a painting such as the Battle of the Boyne, or a historical figure such as Sir Walter Raleigh or whatever, that it brings huge life to the work that they're trying to convey if they actually have the images. I think teachers in a formal setting are constantly looking for new ways that they can really interest children in a subject. And teachers will always talk about the difficulty of the classroom setting, that it really pigeonholes, while they accept that that's the limits within which they work. But teachers that interact with us here in the gallery and come in for sessions or whatever will always say what a difference it makes to them when they're teaching the history of art or whatever, and they're trying to explain that Renaissance painters used a particular approach, and that 19th century realist French artists were trying to look at a more natural approach to nature, and then in the 20th century the cubists and the modern artists kind of threw that upside down and were far more concerned with how they felt about the subject. And they will all say that, you know, once they talk about it and they're trying to explain it, as soon as they come into the gallery and the guides take over, that they can actually see the children understanding what it is they've been trying to convey, that actually seeing the real thing and looking at thick paint on a painting, and they'll have said, you know, this is called impasto, or as one child described it to me, big lumps of paint on a picture, which is an accurate description. But when they actually see a painting by Yeats and they see these big thick masses of paint, or flat areas, and the teacher has been trying to explain that you paint with a flat palette teacher, and then the teacher shows them a very flat area of paint and explains you couldn't get that with the paintbrush, but with the flat palette they can actually see with their own eyes a lot of these ideas the teachers are talking about. So I think the informal setting of a gallery is hugely complementary to the formal teaching process.
And Mary, at a personal level, how did your career to date lead you to your current position as keeper and head of education here?
Well, if I looked at the general education officers who were in the gallery, by and large, most of them would have done art history in Trinity or UCD or NCAD or Crawford and Cork or wherever, University of Ulster, that they would have basically done an art history degree, although that's not essential. It certainly works out better for them. And they would probably have done an internship somewhere in another museum or abroad. And they would probably then have done a master's, not necessarily in art history. It might be in cultural policy or arts administration or possibly in art history. And then they would have tried to have gotten a little bit of experience in museums. That's the general way most people would go about working in a museum. For myself, I took a slightly different route. There weren't quite so many options open when I finished school, and I always wanted to work in art and in museums. So I went to college in France for a year, where I studied French. But while I was there, I spent most of my time drawing. Then I was in England for 6 months, and I went to St. Martin's College of Fine Art. And while I was drawing there, I spent most of my time visiting the museums. And then I decided I wanted to go to college, so I went to UCD, and I did 4 years studying the history of art and archaeology. And during that time, I changed subject, which is why I did 4 years. And I went to Paris one summer where I worked, and I went to London one summer working in on an archaeological dig, and I visited Windsor Castle. And then in my final summer, I worked on the Rosk exhibition in the Hugh Lane Gallery, Dublin City Gallery, the Hugh Lane. And then when I actually finished college, I went teaching in St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra, teaching the history of art there to primary school forthcoming teachers, so to speak, while I was trying to put together the basis of ideas for a master's. And then out of the blue, I felt I really wanted to get experience in a museum. So I went to New York, where I had a few friends, and I worked in the drawing centre in Soho. And then I went, they recommended I work in a bigger museum, so I went up to the Metropolitan Museum, where I worked for a couple of months, and came back to Ireland then after a year. Went back training in St. Patrick's College in Drumcondra and doing a little bit of other teaching. And it was during that year, when I was just about to go to Boston to do some research for an institute here, the gallery job, indeed three jobs came up, an arts council, a gallery, and a regional arts officer job came up. And I applied for them, and the gallery would have been my first love. So that's how I came here. And then over time, when I came here, there was, you know, very basic structures in place, and the directors helped to get the funding to actually build up proper departments. So I would have been in the position of taking over from a previous education officer and working to find the arguments to fight for staff and proper facilities for the public. And then in the last decade, I worked on my PhD. But I have to say, and it is a very simple thing for me to say, I've done a lot of writing and publishing. For me, I don't regard my job in the gallery as a job. I regard it as a way of life. And because we're open 7 days a week, year round, the blurs of your working day becomes blurred. You might come in early to meet people or have a meeting. At lunchtime, like today, there isn't any lunchtime. I'm here doing an interview with you. We're open late on a Thursday evening, so I'm normally here supervising or maybe giving a lecture or something like that. We have programs here on Saturdays and Sunday. You will often drop in just to check that everything's going okay, or you'll have an eminent speaker from overseas who you want to greet. So it's more a way of life, you know. People love it and they become passionate about it, or after a period of time they move on to something like teaching. And I have to say, I take a lot of interns on, and I'm a passionate believer in training people to have some training in museums so that they can find out where they want to move on. There's certainly a number of people who've come to me from art history over the years who I would have encouraged to go into primary school teaching, because I think the more and more good teachers at primary level, and the primary school curriculum is fantastic. Having somebody like that with artistry background at primary school level is really fantastic start for teacher, teach for children. And then, of course, they know all about the museums and the galleries, so they're obviously going to use their local museum, their local gallery. So it's a great way of building up a much broader knowledge about teaching, about the subject, and about all the different tools and cultural institutions that are available to teachers.
And finally, Mary, what's your own favourite painting in the gallery?
Believe it or not, that is the one question I hate. And I would answer that question, well, you mean my favourite picture today? Because it might have been Mantegna yesterday. It might be Burton's The Blind Girl at the Holy Well, or The Iron Fisherman's Drowned Child today. Tomorrow, it could be a landscape by Thomas Roberts. I actually don't have a favourite. I find that particularly when the curators rehang the collection or there's an exhibition on and the paintings move around, I find just when you think you're familiar with the painting, like, for example, we have two works by Mei Tzu, Man Writing a Letter and Woman Reading a Letter. And these are works that you would know from having hanging upstairs near Vermeer in the Dutch collection. But when they were removed for an exhibition a couple of years ago and you saw them in the exhibition room, it was like it was the first time you'd ever seen them, because they were hung in a different context with different works. And likewise, the Taking Stock exhibition that ended yesterday, which showed acquisitions we've purchased over the last 10 years, like the portrait of Count John McCormack or the Roderick O'Connor still life or the Boucher nude of Madame Louise O'Morphy, the mistress of Louis the 15th. When you see them hanging in an exhibition like that, you know, you're suddenly, you see them with other portraits and you, gosh, I never noticed that before. Whereas when they go into a room, after a while, you think you're familiar with them. And with the painting, that should never be the case, or a work of art should always be inviting you to see something new. So even though you might think, well, I really love 19th century painting or whatever, you will find that as you move around the gallery, your eyes are constantly interacting with the work and you're always spotting something new about it. So I'm not going to give you an answer to that question.
And answering all of those questions very comprehensively, I think, was Dr. Mary Burke from the National Gallery of Ireland. I have time to bring you just one item on our notice board this week. I got an email from Paula Cullen during the week asking me to tell you about an upcoming event to honour the educational achievements of members of the travelling community. This event is held in the Civic Offices, Wood Quay, with kind support from Dublin City Council. Now, it's not on until October, but the award is now open for nominations for all travellers, regardless of age, who have completed their Junior Cert, Leaving Cert, GCSE or A-levels in 2010, right across the island of Ireland. If you would like to nominate someone for the award, you can obtain application forms by calling 872-1094. That number again is 872-1094, or you can email info@exchangehouse.ie. The event will be held on October 22nd. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on www.insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us on insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to this week's guests, Dr. Mary Burke and Pat King, and to Barry Hennessy for The View From Here. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.